Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Today, our interviewee is Eric S. Raymond. How you doing, Eric?
I'm good.
Good. We had a little problem with whispering robots in the Skype before we started, but we worked it out and troubleshot it to death. And, you know, I always say computers are an interesting mix of science and voodoo, and I think we got the voodoo out of it today. So, Eric is a pretty amazing guy. I wanted to interview him because I saw him in a movie called Revolution OS about the open source movement. And I talked to my friend Kyle, who's a programmer, saying I was going to interview him. And I was like, yeah, Eric's pretty popular with programmers, isn't he? And he's like, that's kind of like saying Jimmy Page was a kind of popular guitar player. So we got a rock star here today. Rock star.
You'll make me blush.
Yeah. I don't think so, man. I've read your blog and I like it. And you've got a very healthy ego, and so do I. And you deserve it. You wrote a book called, or an essay called, "The Cathedral and the Bazaar," which basically helped created the open source movement. It convinced Netscape to release their source code, which they were the first major company to do that. Eric had something to do with keeping Congress from applying metering fees to the internet back in the day and applying phone fees to things like Skype and Mumble. So it's,
I don't think I had anything to do with that. I was involved in the big anti-censorship push in the 90s, though.
Okay. What did I say that's incorrect there?
I don't think I was involved in avoiding metering on Skype, or at least if I was, somebody may have quoted me without my knowing it. I was involved in the anti-censorship push back in the days of the Communications Decency Act, though.
Ah. Okay. I think I got that one thing from your blog, but it might have been someone else saying it. You wrote some of the code that's in every commercial application of GNU and Linux, correct?
Well, okay, that sounds a little distorted. What is true is that I have been a maintainer or a principal contributor to the graphics libraries for two of the three main internet graphics formats, which means every time you use a graphical browser or look at a display on a smartphone, those bits are coming through my code.
Excellent. Thank you. I use those often and enjoy them, and don't really understand or know that much about the magic that goes on behind them, the science.
That's okay. I know these things, so you don't have to.
there was something in passing in your blog that sounded like you had something to do with influencing Tim Berners-Lee to invent the World Wide Web. Is that true? I mean, what's the details on that?
Maybe. I don't really know. This is actually an interesting little corner of history, and someday maybe I'll get a chance to ask him in person. Way back when, I in the early 90s, I was working on a project called the Jargon File. This is a big compendium of internet slang, which actually turned out to be tremendously influential later on, but that's getting ahead of the story. I had marked the Jargon File up in a special format where you could get a text dump of it in a format where all the cross links to terms in the file, to dictionary entries, were surrounded by set brackets. And I thought of this simply as a convenient low overhead way for people to be able to look at a word and see, oh, well, that's a term elsewhere in the dictionary, I can look it up. Some guy in the Midwest, some DOS programmer whose name I'm not currently remembering, thought, wow, we could automate that lookup. So he wrote what we would now call a little browser application that would load up the file, make an index of it, and then you could be browsing it, and you could click on, you could put your terminal cursor over one of these bracketed entries and hit return, and it would go to that entry. I mean, this was basically chasing a hyperlink, which is not a weird concept to us now, but this was pre-web. The web hadn't deployed yet. So I took this program and I ported it to Linux and I published it as Volks Hypertext, VH. A few weeks or a few months later, I don't remember when, I think this would have been in 91 sometime, I got a letter from an at the time unknown computer science researcher at CERN who said, hey, I've been working on some hypertexting too, and shall we collaborate? And so I sent him back a reply that said, yeah, sure, standardization is great. Let's cooperate. I never heard from him again. His name was Tim Berners-Lee, and this was just before the web hit. So there is just a possibility that that Volk's hypertext, which I got from this guy in the Midwest and then ported to Unix and did the jargon file on, there's just a possibility that that may have influenced the development of HTML. I don't know. It depends on how I would have to ask Tim Berners-Lee.
Well, HTML, I believe, existed before, or it's a subset of standard markup language, but it wasn't across a network, right?
Correct.
And was your you were doing the jump thing of this, click this, it goes there. Did that, was that across a network or within an individual computer?
No, it was within an individual computer. So I did not have the idea of cross-site links.
Cool. Tim Berners-Lee is a hero of mine. I actually wrote him a fan letter. I write fan letters to scientists. It's weird. I also wrote one to Douglas Engelbart. He's a pretty heavy cat. You ever meet him?
Who?
Douglas Engelbart?
Meet him. I stayed at his place once.
Awesome.
Yeah. On one of my trips out to the valley, I stayed overnight at his place and hung out with him a bit.
I used to brag to people about things like, yeah, when my band was touring and we stayed in Austin, we stayed with the drummer from the Butthole Surfers. But I actually these days think it's a lot cooler that you met Tim Berners-Lee.
No, I didn't meet Berners-Lee. I met Engelbart.
Berners-Lee, yeah,
not yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I met Buckminster Fuller when I was 10. That kind of changed my life. He's a heavy.
Really?
Guy. Yeah. Met him in Chautauqua, New York, when he gave a lecture there. It was on his 84th birthday. Just met him, shook his hand, standing in line with a bunch of people. But that's cool. Met Frederick Ordway, too, who was the... You know who he is?
No.
Kind of one of the fathers of the space program, and he was the technical advisor on 2001 A Space Odyssey. But
interesting.
I digress.
So there's one very important concept I've actually carried away from... from Buckminster Fuller, and I've cited it a lot in my work. He talked about ephemeralization. You remember that idea? This is the process that Fuller was the first to identify. That's a major theme in modern technology, where over time, both our individual technologies and our civilization as a whole gets less material intensive and more information intensive. We keep replacing atoms with design. And a perfect example is the evolution of portable phones. Back when they were first available, they were these huge, these monster 20 or 30 pound things that also had to have an auxiliary box in your car, and they were clunky, and they were slow, and they were really expensive. And over time, they got smaller and smaller and lighter and lighter and thinner, but the decrease in physical size was accompanied by, and in fact enabled by, a tremendous increase in the internal complexity of the device. Information was being substituted for mass. And Buckminster Fuller called this ephemeralization, and I think it's a very important concept.
I love the guy, and I loved his work. He also had a problem that a lot of scientists seem to have, and this is something I want to get into later. He really thought that the smartest people should be running society, and he actually is the guy who came up with the idea of carbon credits. Did you know that?
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah, I was watching this movie you were in called Revolution OS, which is really, really good movie. I'm going to link it, and I recommend it to people. It's you can watch it streaming on Netflix and elsewhere. I really dug it. I was watching it. I was thinking, you know, there's two or three cats in here I'd really love to interview for my libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, firearms, computer security podcast. But as it went on, I kept thinking, I'll bet that all of them who, you know, think software should be open probably think that government should regulate everything else. They just have and probably think that guns are icky. A lot of them just kind of had that vibe until I heard you screaming, no, open source is not communism. Communism is where they take you to a gulag and put a bullet in your brain, which sounds like something I'd scream. And I went and looked at your website and found out you're a libertarian and a gun nut. And I was like, okay, bingo, that's the guy. Was I correct in my assumption about some of the other people in that movie?
Some of them, but not all of them. The hacker culture that I'm part of Well, there are a lot of libertarians in it. I won't say that it's libertarian as a whole because that's not true, but it tends to emotionally bend that way.
Yeah, there seems to be this... Ray Kurzweil is a really good example of a scientist who is brilliant and has brought us a lot of the things, you know, optical character recognition, music synthesis, voice to, you know, text to voice, etc. But he really he's a, you know, consultant for the government and UN spinoff groups and really wants to kind of nannyize everything. And he's kind of anti-gun. And there seems to be a lot in science of where people are an absolute expert in one field. And they think that that gives them the ability and right to say how society should be run. Have you encountered that?
No, it's not that simple, and it's not that morally loaded. The real problem isn't that they think they have some kind of individual moral right to say the way society should be run. It's that they overestimate the capacity of planning. They tend to have this assumption that all problems, even messy social ones, will respond as tractably to planning and intellect as the stuff that they're used to dealing with. It's not exactly a moral failing. It's more like an epistemological one.
Who are some of the worst offenders of that, not just in the computer community, but in science in general and computers?
Oh, I don't want to go naming names.
Oh, come on. Man.
That would get me involved in a kind of politics I don't want to be involved in.
Okay, I won't drag you into it, but you have been no fear. You've had no fear of starting beef when you know you're right before. I know that.
Well, part of what's going on there is I pick my battles carefully.
One that you picked that I thought was really interesting, which kind of is where I've come from without really putting it into solid code the way you have and really laying it out, is you said something about how GNU open source licenses, you know, that demand this thing, that thing, and this thing. You were in favor of somewhat eliminating them because you were like, what's the point? I mean, I kind of look at that like, you know, Democrats and Republicans argue till the cows come home about eliminating, you know, about the separation of church and state. And my answer is always, let's get rid of the state or let's get rid of the state run schools. Why do we have to worry about what people are saying in them? So talk a bit about your license, your elimination of licensing idea for open source.
Okay. You're probably talking about my criticism of the GNU General Public License.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, there are two classes of license in the open source world, and they're sometimes called reciprocal and non-reciprocal, or if you're feeling unfriendly, viral and non-viral. And a permissive license, one that's not reciprocal, one that's non-viral, is one that simply says, here's the code, do anything you like with it, and sometimes maybe it has a provision in it that says, but don't misrepresent the author's name. That's a permissive license, lets you do anything you like. There's another tradition of reciprocal licenses, which and the best known of these is the GNU General Public License, which says, okay, this code is free, and because we want it to stay free, we're going to require that any derivative work of this code be issued under the same terms as this code. In other words, once any change you make to this code also has to be public. Which is, I mean, it's a nice idea. In general, I'm in favor of when people use the commons to contribute back to it. The problem with reciprocal licensing and the problem with the GPL is that it frightens people, especially frightens lawyers. If you are a lawyer at a Fortune 500 company, a lot of these places, I know from experience, have policies that say, we're not going to let any open source in the door. And the reason they have this policy is because they've heard that the GPL requires all derivative works of a piece of code to be issued, that's GPL, to be issued under GPL. And their thought is, oh, God, no, we'll have to give away all our corporate secrets. It will infect all our databases. It will infect all our code. It will run rampant like an IP virus through everything we own, and we will be naked before our enemies. This is complete nonsense, of course.
Well,
now I'm getting an echo again.
Could something without licensing become popular?
How do you mean without licensing?
I mean, it seems like if you don't have the limitations of that license that spell out what can be done with it and what can't, if you just say, hey, man, I don't believe in licenses. There's nothing on this. You can do what you want with it. Would that scare lawyers more than an open source license?
No, I'm saying that the non-reciprocal ones, the one that don't have a derivative works provision, scare lawyers much less. The problem is the GPL is very widely used, and because of it, open source in general has acquired a bad odor at some places that are unreasonably afraid of it and shouldn't be. So the result is this well-intentioned attempt to enforce sharing has ended up slowing down the adoption rate of open source in general. And my critique is, well, maybe we should stop doing that.
Do you mean stop using that license and use a different one, or stop using a license?
Stop using viral licenses. We can't use stop using licenses at all, because copyright has this annoying property that it defaults closed. If you want people to be able to reuse your stuff without worrying that they'll get sued, you have to put a license on it that says they can do so. Because, as I said, copyright defaults closed. It defaults all rights reserved. So we can't do without licensing at all. The choice is between the choices about how restrictive we want our open source licenses to be, and what I say is they should be as non-restrictive as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of has to come off of copyright, at least in the U.S., because the government has the monopoly on that sort of thing. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I don't believe in copyright. I use Creative Commons, but they don't understand that Creative Commons is a set of intentional non-limitations within copyright.
It's an attempt to use the copyright system against itself, yes.
Yeah.
And the new GPL is like that, too.
Yeah, I actually put something out in 1991 before Creative Commons was public. It was a DVD called DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist. It was a documentary interview with a bunch of artists and a couple of programmers. And I didn't like copyright, but I wanted to be able to have a copyright on it to protect it from, say, you know, someone using it in a beer commercial without my permission. So I kind of invented something like Creative Commons that wasn't as legalese. I called the DVD DIY or Die, Burn This DVD, and in it had a really short one paragraph saying anybody who buys this can make 10 non-commercial copies for anyone else and give them away or sell them for a buck, and anyone who receives one of those can do the same thing. You know, if somebody had bootlegged 10,000 of them, I would have gone after him with a lawyer. Or if they'd used something from it, you know, in a beer commercial, I would have gone after him. But it was kind of like Creative Commons, but not quite as well codified. So
Actually, you're touching on my beef with Creative Commons. They have a switch that you can pull on that license that says no commercial use. That's a dangerous switch.
Yeah, I saw your post on that. It's kind of a death knell of, like, no one will touch using it.
Yeah, because there's no bright line for commercial use, so you're laying a trap for people in the future by pulling that switch, and I wish people wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I now release stuff Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike, which allows commercial, I believe. It does.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a better model.
Yep. So, is it correct to call you the grandfather or granddaddy of the open source movement?
Wow, how much historical detail would you like?
Because
that doesn't have a simple answer.
Okay, let's ask something else and then take a little break and then come back with that one.
Okay.
What operating system is on the computer in front of you?
It's Ubuntu Linux.
Do you own any Microsoft devices or Apple devices?
None. Why would I bother with that crap?
I don't know, because it's easy for me.
It's all crashy and insecure and badly engineered. I don't want any of it.
I know. I'm kind of looking over at my Windows XP computer I'm recording this on going, okay, it's 18 minutes. I 20 minutes. I got to stop it and save the file, because that's based on experience. What do you do for a living now?
I do consulting work. Sometimes investment bankers will pay me $300 an hour to give them economic analysis. I have book royalties. I have various other sources of income. None of it comes from selling software.
Do you make a comfortable living, or do you scramble, or are you rich?
It's like sporadic lumps of money come in, and those are over time. They average out to enough to pay the bills. Fortunately, my wife had a good job. Unfortunately, she got laid off in January, so it's a little less secure than it used to be, but we're not hurting and won't be for a while.
I do the same thing. I call it mailbox money. I make a living at mailbox money. It's a good term for it. Do you have cats?
One.
What's your cat's name? What kind of cat?
Sugar. She looks like your basic American tabby, a little larger than average. Green eyes, black, gray, and some brown fur. We think she's part Maine Coon. She's got really thick, fleshy fur. Very, very friendly personality.
We have two cats that are part Maine Coon, and they're friggin' nuts. Is your cat kind of nuts and really animated and loves water?
No, she's actually kind of tranquil, but she does love water.
Maine Coons love
water. And she's got the Maine Coon trait of she vocalizes a lot. She's got a very wide range of noises. Yeah.
Yep.
And like Maine Coon, she really loves people. I mean, she loves all human beings.
Awesome. I'm going to save the file, and then we'll come back and talk for 20 minutes about open source, and then we'll talk for 20 minutes about guns and politics. How's that sound?
Okay.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So would it be accurate to call you the godfather of the open source movement?
Well, as I said before, that's complicated. You want some history?
Yeah, man, I want about 20 minutes of it.
Okay, so the open source movement as we know it today is the latest phase of a tradition that goes back decades, long before the internet, long before most people ever heard of it, which is the original agriculture, which goes back to academia and research labs in the 1960s, and developed a whole set of slang and folklore and hero stories and jokes, and also developed this craft practice of sharing the code that they wrote. They would casually pass around source code, and they came to really value this behavior. There are several sources of this culture. MIT AI Lab is one. The early Unix hackers at Bell Labs in Berkeley is another. What happened was that in the early 90s, some of the people in this culture started writing entire operating system platforms. You see, previously, before that, open source code software, which hadn't been named yet, we didn't have that label, only existed in fragments. It was small applications and pieces of things that mostly ran on top of various proprietary operating systems, Sun workstations and things like that, mostly Unix machines. But in the early 90s, the thing that started to happen was that powerful 32-bit microcomputers were available for the first time. That had started in 87. And so people started writing entire operating systems, entire Unixes. And the best known of these, of course, is Linux, but there were actually others. There were a couple of spin-offs of the BSD Unix. And the idea of open source developed more explicitly, although we still didn't have a name for it around then. People started to think, wow, a really good use for my time would be making these free Unixes more powerful and more capable. And what happened then was that I got an early distribution of Linux, and I looked at it and I said, wow, this is much better than it should be, because you see, I had been immersed in conventional software engineering theory, which says that in order to make a large project work, you need a really small, well-focused team, and it needs to be planned out the wazoo, and all the objectives need to be carefully specified. And the last thing that can possibly work is a huge, acephalous mob that is all happens to be sort of flying in one direction, and there's no planning or anything. And yet this acephalous mob of Linux hackers produced a world-class operating system as early as 1993, and I looked at this and said, this should not be possible. And at that point, I'd already had 20 years of history in the hacker culture that was producing this stuff. We're also the people who built the early internet and got it deployed out in the early 90s. So I had 20 years of experience among the people who had built a lot of the Unix code and a lot of the internet code and the early Linux distributions. So when I looked at this and said, this should not be possible. How are these people getting away with breaking all the conventional rules of software engineering? So I sat down and I thought and I studied and I examined the community around me for a couple of years, and then I wrote my first landmark paper, and the accident that happened, I thought that I was simply describing an interesting craft practice that led to good results. You do rapid iterations. You solicit lots of feedback. You have a really transparent, open process where anyone can criticize the code, and shazam, you get good code. I thought I was just describing a better craft process. Well, it turned out that, unbeknownst to anybody, including me, I was actually blowing up the world, or at least the software industry, although that didn't become apparent until later on. So the answer to your question is, in one sense, it's actually appropriate to call me the father of the modern open source movement, because I wrote down the foundational theory and I articulated it to the rest of the world. On the other hand, I have always seen myself as operating within a continuous tradition that goes back long past the naming of this way of doing things. And I look up to precursors and leader figures that were around long before I was.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, in a way, going back to before there was copyright, right?
No, you can't go back that far. It's existed since the foundation of the U.S.
Well, you said agriculture. Was that a model that you were emulating?
No, I think you may have misheard what I said. I was talking about the hacker culture.
Ah, okay.
Not agriculture.
Same thing. What was it like back then? I mean, how can I ask how old you are and how long you've been having your hands on computers?
I am pushing 55, and I have been involved in computer programming sporadically since 1972 and seriously since 1976. So I've been at this for a very long time.
Talk more about the cathedral and the bazaar, and explain the premise of it and how it affected the world, please.
Okay, so as I said, I had this problem in that, according to everything I knew about software engineering in 1993, Linux should be impossible. It should be a pile of rubble. It should be complete crap. And yet it wasn't, and that was obvious within 20 minutes of when I first booted it up. So I set myself the challenge of understanding how these people had gotten away with breaking the normal rules. And let me explain the normal rules. They were more or less noticed by a guy named Fred Brooks in 1975, and he was writing from his experience with large software development projects at IBM, and he formulated something called Brooks's Law, and there's a bunch of formal statements of it, but the informal way to put it is adding more programmers to a late software project makes later. And the reason this is because as the number of programmers on a project rises, the amount of work they can do per unit time rises as linearly with the number of programmers, in some way proportional directly to N. But the communications overhead among the programmers rises with the number of two-way connections among them, which is N squared. So as and eventually, as you make the team larger and larger, the effects of increasing communications overhead overwhelm the effect of adding another body. This is what Fred Brooks noticed, and this is why for many years the prescription was small, tightly focused teams so that you hold your N squared down as small as possible. And what I noticed was that somehow the Linux community was producing good software in spite of the fact that Brooks's Law said that this huge mob of developers shouldn't be able to do that. They should be collapsing under the weight of their own communications overhead. So I looked for an explanation. And the explanation that I found is that Brooks's Law isn't repealed exactly, but when you scale your development process to the point where you're doing iterations and test cycles in weeks and days rather than months, and you also have a process that's completely transparent so that anyone in the world can look at and criticize the code, then something really interesting starts to happen. You start to get a velocity of bug diagnoses, fixes, and problem space exploration that's simply impossible when the source code is in secret. And that turned out to be the important thing. It turned out that the open source way of organizing software production was in a strong sense more effective and more efficient than anything we had seen before. And that is why Linux didn't suck. And this is why open source is now such an important method of software development everywhere, even inside the sorts of large corporations that would have been completely proprietary 15 years ago.
And you call this release early, release often, right?
That's right. Release early, release often. Treat your beta testers like precious jewels. The most valuable people in the world are the people who are capable of walking in, reading your code, and spotting a problem that you didn't. And what you do when you open the source is you make it possible for every one of the 6 billion odd people in the world, in principle, to be your critic. And it turns out that's a really good thing.
How is release early, release often different from the Microsoft idea of where Steve Ballmer said, yeah, nothing from Microsoft works until version 3 or something like that?
Well, one major difference is our stuff starts to work well faster.
And they charge more.
Because of this convergence process. They're willing to ship betas and inflict pain on their customers. The difference is the convergence process is a lot slower because a lot fewer people can see and audit the code.
How do you feel about people making millions of dollars on work you did?
If I wasn't okay with that happening, I wouldn't have shipped it under a permissive license.
I like that. And how is that not communism?
Oh, well, I mean, go back to what I said at the beginning of the interview. Communism necessarily involves coercion. If I make something and I decide to share it and lots of other people enjoy it and decide to share their things with me, that's not communism. Communism is when somebody says, if you don't, quote, share, unquote, what you have, I will kill you.
Yeah, it seems to me like a major problem in the world is people being taught at a really young age in public schools and through society that, it's good to share, so therefore we're going to point guns at a bunch of people's heads and steal all their money and then share it in your name.
This is moral idiocy.
Yeah, I mean, what I spend 24/7, I work about 10 hours a week for pay, and I have a hobby that's about 80 hours a week, and this podcast is part of it. What I spend all my time doing now is trying to educate as many people as possible that, charity at the barrel of a gun is immoral and it's not charity at all. And it's really tough, man. Where do you think that the willingness to accept logical fallacies as fact comes from, and what do you think can be done about it?
Well, a large part of the problem is a lot of people still simply aren't very bright and accept the model of the world that's handed to them. But another problem, which we can solve, is a lot of people don't have positive models of ethical sharing and positive individualism. And one of the things that I hope the open source movement does, I view it as a huge demonstration that voluntary cooperation actually works better than coercion. Openness works better than secrecy. Transparent process is better than command and control.
How do you feel about go ahead.
So I think one of the things that we can do as open source hackers, and especially those of us who happen to be libertarians, one of the things we can do is set a good example. We can set an example that people can learn from.
Excellent. You do that in most of what you've done, or all of what I've done that I've seen, all that you've done. And the open source thing has spread, I think, way beyond. I mean, I sound like, some reporter here who's never touched a computer saying, the internet's going to help the world. Tell me about it. But, really, I mean, I see it and feel it and taste it in my everyday, everything I do. I feel the influence of open source software, even in things that are outside of software. And how do you feel about copyright?
My feelings about copyright are complicated and mixed. See, one of the things I haven't figured out is whether intellectual property rights would exist in a free market.
L. Neil Smith says they do. L. Neil Smith, who's an author I love, and I see you like him too. He's basically said, like, I will come over with my gun if you share my books without asking me.
Well, having somebody pissed off at you and prepared to shoot you is not the same as saying a behavior is sustainable in a free market.
Well, I think what he said was, I'm going to send my attorneys from the office of Smith & Wesson over to take care of this.
Well, okay, so let's actually do some economic analysis here. One of the things that I had to do in order to understand the social dynamics of open source was develop a general theory of property rights, where they come from, why we have them. I wrote a paper that was in large part about that. It was called Homesteading the Noosphere. You might want to read it. And one of the basic insights was you have a system of stable property rights when the enforcement costs of enforcing a right do not exceed the benefit that you actually gain from exercising it. And my example of this, there are a couple of good anthropological examples of this in land tenure. Okay, so consider the Kalahari Desert. Let's look at the property customs they have there. You're a random tribe of wandering Bushmen or Hottentots or whatever the politically correct term is today, does not claim to own large random patches of desert. This is because large random patches of desert are worthless. On the other hand, they do have ownership customs that regulate water holes, because water holes are actually valuable, and you can put enough people around a water hole to actually defend it if some other tribe shows up to try and claim it from you. So, water holes, concentrated benefits, defense of the property right is possible. They've actually developed a set of customary laws that regulate that very much as though it's real property on the model we understand it. Large random patches of desert, not treated as property because the enforcement costs are too high to make the game worthwhile. On the other hand, in places that are a little more blessed by nature, there is this thing called farmland where we grow a lot of our food. Defending it has a great deal of value. The surplus that you can extract from it by farming it is pretty valuable. And that means that you can afford to pay for the enforcement costs to defend title. And we do, in fact, have a land property system. So this illustrates my general point. You don't have a sustainable property system unless the costs of defense are below the cost of the payoff from exercising the right. Now, let's look a little deeper. There was an economist named Thomas Schelling who originally was studying the dynamics of nuclear warfare between superpowers who don't trust each other. He came up with the notion of a Schelling point, which is a natural place for parties to meet, even if they don't trust each other and can't communicate reliably. For example, if I were to say to you, let's meet in downtown Philadelphia. If you are a native Philadelphian and I did not specify a location, there is a Schelling point. There is a sort of a default meeting place in downtown Philadelphia, which is a gigantic sculpture of a clothespin. If you are not a Philadelphian and don't live in this area, you don't know about this. If you are a Philadelphian, it's part of the local custom. That is one of our Schelling points. Even parties that can't reliably communicate, if they want to meet somewhere, that's where they're going to go. Similarly, let's take the example of two people who are living on adjacent hills in a pre-literate, pre-law society where they don't actually have any established laws. All they got is clubs and spears. Okay, so here you are in your hut, and here I am in mine, and we're about a mile from each other, and now we're in kind of a state of tension because neither of us knows how far we can go towards the other guy's hut without having that be interpreted as a hostile move, a challenge. But now, suppose there's a small creek running between our huts. Something has just happened. The creek is a natural boundary in that the cost of enforcing an exclusion from what I think of as my property rises once I cross the creek because it's harder to get back to my place and easier for you to get reinforcements from yours. The creek is a Schelling point. All shelling points are in property rights are places where there's a jump, there's an abrupt change in the gradient of enforcement costs. And there are lots of these for normal sorts of physical property. One of these is there's this legal maxim, possession is nine-tenths of the law. One of our shelling points is that we agree that if somebody has physical possession of a thing, unless there's evidence otherwise, that person is presumed to be the owner. Well, the problem is, in the area of intellectual property law, I haven't found any shelling points yet. That I haven't found any places where there's a break in the gradient of enforcement costs. That may mean that no free market would ever develop a system of stable IP rights. I don't know the answer to that one yet. It bothers me.
All right.
So there's two ways to look at copyright. Either it's a sort of artificial government monopoly, which doesn't correspond to anything a free market would ever develop, in which case it's illegitimate, we ought to junk it. Or government is merely substituting, as it often inefficiently does, for an institution that a free market would develop on its own terms because the economics make it come out right, in which case copyright would survive in a free market system and it's okay. I don't know which of those universes we live in. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
Do you have any works? I mean, you put stuff out. We put stuff out on different presses. Some people put copyrights on it. Some people don't. I know O'Reilly, who we've both written for or had stuff published by, kind of releases everything. I think Creative Commons or makes it available or doesn't care. Do you have anything that you'd be upset if someone shared it freely?
No. Cool. If it's publicly available, you can generally presume that I don't mind having it shared around. One thing I do not like is having my stuff modified and shared.
Yeah, because that's kind of saying you said something you didn't say.
Right.
Yeah. Are you talking about software or books or both?
Oh, I'm talking about my essays, too.
Yeah.
I want people to see them as I wrote them, and if they're mirrored somewhere, I want to point it back to the original so that if I modify the content, people will be able to find the modifications.
You seem to do what I do a lot, which is write something groundbreaking, publish it, and then go back and do revisions on it. You had a revision history. I usually don't, but... where does that come from with you? I know where it comes from with me, but I have this like pressing need to get something out there, and then I sleep on it a few days and read it again and find a couple typos and find a couple different stronger ways to say something.
It's a software development habit. I never assume that release 1.0 is the last answer.
Essay 1.6. Yeah, I do it with movies, too. I mean, when we did a movie called Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, and we released like four different versions of it because the laws on guns and weed just kept changing. And finally, we just said, okay, this is canonical. We just need to leave it. And it called it 3.3. But, yeah. So, guns.
What about them?
What are you carrying right now?
Well, it's been actually physically on me at the moment, but my normal carry... Well, because I'm in my home, it's about a foot from my hand. Okay, my normal carry weapon is a short-barreled 45, a Kimber Ultra 3. Ever seen one of those?
Yes, the ones that are kind of 1911-y looking, but small.
Yep.
With really pretty
really cool. Like the 1911 pattern. It feels good in my hand. I like the way it rides. I like the big slow bullet. I love that pattern. And my preferred carry weapon is a version of that that's small enough for me to conceal.
Yeah, my wife wants that gun, which is not saying it's a girly gun. My wife carries in her purse a Glock Model 23 40 cal. And I generally carry around the house, believe it or not, a two-shot 22 Derringer because it fits in athletic shorts in the summer. I can go out in the garden with it. You know, they say that a handgun is to fight your way back to your rifle. I say the Derringer is to fight the way back to the handgun. But
yeah, my wife shoots a Glock 40.
Glock 40 caliber.
40 caliber.
Model 23?
Yeah. I'm not remembering which one it is.
Yeah, I have one of those on the nightstand, and I carry it in a shoulder holster when I leave the property. But on the property, I have the Derringer in my pocket so I can fight my way back to the Glock. Is... It seems like a lot of people these days don't like guns. Do you come up against a lot of like incredulousness or derision because you're a
less than I used to? You know, the fact is, we're actually winning the culture war on this one. I mean, it may feel like you run into a lot of anti-gun hostility, but believe me, it's nothing like it was in 1975. Over both the law and the fact that we're winning the culture war is reflected in state-level firearms law. Most of the U.S. is shall issue now, as opposed to at law enforcement's discretion. In fact, I think there are only two discretionary states left in the U.S. One of them is Illinois. I've forgotten the other one.
I live in Hawaii. Hawaii doesn't have permits, yeah. I think, and Illinois. New Jersey's bad. California's bad. Maryland's bad. Everybody else is okay. I live in Wyoming, where it's not only shall issue, it's, as of a year ago, you do not need a permit to conceal carry a gun.
Yeah, constitutional carry. Wyoming, Alaska, and New Hampshire.
And
that's where we got to get
to. No, Vermont. Vermont. It's Vermont,
Alaska. You're right. It is Vermont.
It's Vermont, Alaska, Wyoming, and Arizona added it about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and the interesting thing is, look, the number of states with constitutional carry is going up, not down. We are actually winning this culture war.
Yeah. I used to live in Pennsylvania. I went to boarding school at the Church Farm School in Paoli or Exton or Lancaster, near Lancaster, if you know where that is.
Well, you know, I live only about 3 miles from that school.
Really? I got kicked out of that school.
Yeah.
For calling the headmaster a fat, bald, overly Christian old fart. And now I'm kind of plump myself, but I'm not. And he's passed away, and his nanny son is running the place now. I don't want to bring beef into this, man. It's such a beautiful day, such a beautiful world, you know? Do you feel optimistic about the future? I mean, there's a lot of crap to get one down. How do you feel about the future?
Pessimistic in the short term, optimistic in the long term.
Do you have kids?
No.
Yeah, I don't either. I think that kind of changes how... I think I'd care more about what... You know, I fight for rights because I want them for me. If other people are too stupid to have them or want them. I have a friend who's got an interest...
No.
Oh, go ahead.
I actually care about people in the future being free. That is an emotional issue for me.
I do. I mean, I'm sounding kind of like, it's kind of macho libertarian flash to say, yeah, all I can care about is myself because people disappoint me. But no, I do. I just think, man, some days I just think we're effed, you know, but not today. Today's a good day.
Well, you know, the attitude I have about that is do the best work you can and keep your powder dry.
Are you a rifle?
That's all we can ever do.
Are you a rifle guy too? Do you do rifle shooting?
I'm sort of competent with rifles, but I'm not really good with them. I'm better with pistols.
I'm amazed how many science people I've talked to are really anti-gun because, I mean, guns are rocket science in your pocket. How cool is that? You know, it's just Newtonian. It's Newtonian physics you can hold in your hand. Why wouldn't they love that?
Campus conditioning, usually.
Yeah. Did you go to college?
I did.
How was it? Where'd you go?
University of Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And one of the formative events of my life, actually, was going to a young socialist movement at the a young socialist meeting at the University of Pennsylvania, and looking around me and noticing these people are all rich white kids in shock your parents mode.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said
I don't want any part of this.
Most people who say workers of the world unite have never worked a day in their life, is what I say. But
indeed it is so.
Yeah.
And I decided I didn't want any part of them, and then I found out what they were actually peddling, and I didn't want any part of it even more.
Yeah. University of Pennsylvania, is that Penn State or is that the other one?
Oh, God, no. Oh, that's an offensive thing to say.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, University of Pennsylvania people hate it when you say that. No, Penn State is a state university, which is not a bad university. It's not at all a bad school for a state university. University of Pennsylvania is a very old private university that was actually established by Benjamin Franklin, if I'm remembering my history correctly. And it's sort of the bottom rung of the Ivy League.
And it is the other one Ivy League or not?
Oh, no, no. State schools are not Ivy League. Trust me on this.
Okay.
that is a sobriquet that is reserved for very old, very prestigious private universities.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, my sister has a PhD from Cornell and knows how to run the world.
There you go. That's your Ivy League.
Yeah, and I used to play a drummer in a band of mine. Michael Berbe is a professor at Penn State, and he is one of the guardians of nannyism. He's written books called "What's Liberal About the Liberal Arts" that are like bestsellers. And without the state, the children would die and be in brothels. He's one of those guys. So without the state. Without the state, would children die and be in brothels?
No.
Why?
Our average wealth level is way too high for that.
Good. Are you still a member of the Libertarian Party?
No.
No?
Actually, I've never been formally a member.
Your blog,
I'm not a member now.
Your blog says you are. Or your website says you are.
No, I describe myself, I believe I describe myself as a small L libertarian. I have supported the Libertarian Party, but I've never been formally a member. I'm having trouble supporting it these days, though.
Me too. I was the Wyoming chair for the RLC, the Republican Liberty Caucus, which is, you know, trying to do the same thing, but through the Republican Party.
Libertarianize the Republicans.
Yeah, yes. And that worked out real well.
So
they perverted it to the
Tea
Party.
I have a couple problems with the LP. One is the LP, the Libertarian Party, is so completely inept at propaganda that when the largest anti-statist insurgency in American history happened, the LP was not able to get on top of it. I'm referring, of course, to the Tea Party. What kind of bloody incompetence does it take to not be able to get in front of that parade when you've been talking about small government for decades?
Well,
that's what told me that the LP was completely ineffective.
Well, my understanding of the Tea Party is that some Ron Paul supporters about 4 years ago had a April 15th tax protest, as they often do, and the Republican neocons jumped in front of that bandwagon and co-opted it and perverted it, you know, and said, Tea Party, small government, but we need to bomb all the brown people and keep drugs illegal and, you know, do the QE 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc.
And one of my problems with the Tea Party is that there is a bit of a stench of social conservatism about it.
A bit?
Which I don't really want to be part of.
A bit?
Now, the thing is, if the Libertarian Party had been on its game, it would have gotten out in front of the Tea Party surge, co-opted it, and purged the damn social conservatives. But the LP was too frickin' incompetent to do that. And that's why I'm not real happy with the LP today. Well, it's one of several reasons.
Do you think government can be fixed through government?
Well, if I did, I wouldn't call myself an anarchist, would I?
I didn't know you did. I'm glad you do. Your website, which hasn't been updated in a while, says you're a libertarian. I mean, I'd say I'm a libertarian and an anarchist. They're not mutually exclusive, but... you know, libertarian is just the anonym of authoritarian and anarchist.
Well, probably the most precise definition of my political stance you could have is that I'm I'd call myself a Friedmanite anarcho-capitalist.
Cool. That
is in the sense that the name theorist that I'm closest to, both theoretically and actually personally, he's a friend of mine, is David Friedman.
Yeah. I like that definition. It's pretty close to my definition. I have a problem with definitions, not because, I don't want to put labels on things, but because every label has too much weight or is unclear. You know, if you say you're a voluntarist, they think you want to build Habitat for Humanity. If you say I'm an anarchist, they think you want to blow stuff up. If you say anarcho-capitalist, they think that sounds like the worst of both worlds. You know, if you say agorist, they think you're a farmer. So I'm still looking for the right term. Should have a contest.
I've settled for calling myself an anarcho-capitalist and explaining it when it seems required.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do. Yep. So what else, man? What makes you happy these days and makes you excited?
Oh, what makes me happy and what makes me excited? Well, one of the things I'm working on is pretty exciting. It turns out that there's a foundational architectural problem with the internet.
I'm not laughing because I think you're wrong. I'm laughing because it's a pretty big thing to have a foundational problem with. I mean, are we talking like the naysaying that there was about the Y2K problem, or what is it?
Oh, no. It's very different in nature. No, it turns out that, well, we made a mistake. There's a... I'm not going to try and explain it all here, but it turns out that too much network buffering is a bad thing. Too much buffering in your network can actually produce some, let's just say, some unhappily chaotic phenomena. And this is the reason why, this is probably the reason why you have dropouts in your videos and crazy long latency spikes. Everybody thinks it's because the pipes aren't wide enough. I'm actually part of a group of old internet hands that thinks the problem isn't the pipes aren't wide enough. The problem is we got the queuing strategies on our buffers wrong. And we've actually been able to come up with some better queuing strategies and start to deploy them, and it makes the internet like three orders of magnitude faster. The bad news is now we have to update the firmware on 2 billion machines. This is not a small problem.
How are you solving that?
A variety of ways. We're talking to equipment manufacturers, and we're talking to smartphone manufacturers, and we're arranging to get deployments at key points, and we're continuing to do research on better queuing algorithms. One of the efforts I'm involved in is we want to create a real-time health monitoring network for the internet so we can do actual precision packet timing with reliable clocks and figure out exactly where the bottlenecks are. So that one of the things I'm working on these days is fixing the internet, and that's where I belong. Really, that's probably where my highest value to civilization is right now.
I think that's what your business card should say. You know, fixing the internet since 1976 or something.
Well, I've been doing a lot of other things too.
Yeah. You know, when I think about, I am filled with awe when I think about the progress that's been made with computers, and I rarely talk to people who've been, you know, down in the trench digging and building that like you. When I was born in 1964, you know, a computer in 1964 filled a room. You know, if you'd showed someone an Android phone in an Android phone in 1964 to a computer scientist in a lab coat, you know, running this room full of equipment, and said, you know, this is going to be a computer later in your life, it would have blown them away. I kind of use that as an analogy for how I think LibPair or Libertarian Paradise could happen. You know, I think it seems so far away and so impossible, and so many authoritarians just keep clamping down on everything so often, and it seems like computing is the one of the places where I've really seen it in my lifetime change drastically. And you know,
here's the thing that can cheer you up.
Okay.
So economics is on our side, reality is on our side. Minimal government and anarchy are better because they have more efficient outcomes. And that means reality and economics are on our side. We're going to win eventually. It may take a lot of blood. It may take a lot of time, but we're going to win eventually. And until we do, the right thing to do is just keep fighting for liberty in all of the little ways that you can. And if you can find a big way to do it, do that too. But just keep fighting for liberty in all the little ways that you can. And you'll, even if you don't live to see us win, you'll know you did your best at least. That's how I live my life.
That's awesome, and I feel like that should be the last thing you say in this, but I actually have two more questions.
Okay.
So everyone can just imagine we cut that out and put it at the end. You're a black belt in karate, right?
Taekwondo, specifically.
Do you know an anarcho-capitalist philosopher, popular guy named Stefan Molyneux?
I believe that I actually met him once.
He's great
at a Reason Foundation event.
And brilliant, and can explain. He does videos, he does podcasts where he explains liberty and anarchy in such an amazing way. He's not a gun guy. I've interviewed him. He thinks that, well, just don't go to bad neighborhoods and you don't need guns. But he actually recently, someone called him up and, you know, said, was talking about doctors and the problem with, you know, state run medicine. And he said, you know, a lot of what I've solved in my life with health issues, physical and mental, I've done through my practice of, martial arts. And Stefan Molyneux went into this tirade of saying that, you know, martial arts is anyone who practices martial arts probably was abused as a child, and that's the only reason they're into it. And it comes down to nothing more than hitting, and that's all it is. Would you like to debunk that at all?
Oh, that's so absolutely wrong.
I thought so,
so
too.
Absolutely wrong. So let me talk about why I do martial arts and what I think it's given me. I have a lot of reasons for doing it, but the one that's probably most important for this interview is that I feel that it's ethically required of me that I be responsible for my own self-defense. It may be that in most practical situations, I need to hand that responsibility off to specialists that I trade with. But I am not willing to allow other people to use violence on my behalf that I wouldn't perform myself. And the consequence of this is that in order to be in an ethically clean place, I need to be physically, intellectually, and morally capable of using violence if I need to. I need to be responsible for my own self-defense. That means learning to be defensively dangerous, whether I have a firearm in my hand, a blade in my hand, or I'm bare-ass naked and there's nothing in my hands. A well-rounded human being, Heinlein said it once. Robert Heinlein once said, a human being should be able to, I'm not going to get all these skills listed, butcher a hog, con a starship, cook a tasty meal, compose poetry, take orders, give orders, build a log cabin, fight effectively, die gallantly. I think that it's incumbent on any well-rounded human being, and especially one who loves liberty, to be competent in their own self-defense, regardless of what weapons they have available or don't have available. And the most important thing about martial arts isn't just that it makes you capable of defending yourself barehanded; it's that it gives you confidence and the warrior spirit. And the interesting paradox is that once you enter into the warrior spirit in that way, you become a very peaceful person because you know violence inside out and you control it and it doesn't control you.
That's awesome. You know, I think that Heinlein quote may be paraphrased in the movie Fight Club. You familiar with that movie?
Which I've never seen.
Which what?
I've never seen it.
Oh. Well, there's a quote there where some people are about to die or have a self-imposed car crash, and the kind of leader of them asks the other ones, "What do you wish you'd have done before you died?" And one says, "Build a house," and the other says, "Paint a self-portrait." It's kind of reminded me of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, hey, good movie. It's got some weird problems, but I recommend it. So, do you have any closing statements, arguments, beefs, Joy?
I guess I want to quote Winston Churchill, never give up. Never, ever, ever, ever give up. Oh, and don't over-specialize because specialization is for insects.
Who said that?
Heinlein again.
That's awesome. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for coming on the Anarchy Gumbo. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
Worms.
Want to contribute to liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding fiends episodes. Follow twitter.com/fiendtorrents to grab the past episodes and new ones as they post. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents, while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding the fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down. That's twitter.com/fiendtorrents.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.